Well, hello again, everyone. This is, once again, your humble correspondent, Turd, with another in the exciting line of TFMR podcasts. Today, I'm very excited to bring to you someone that I've gotten to know over the last few months, and that is Chris Martinson. I think most of you are probably familiar with Chris through his work that he has a wonderful, fabulous website, does a lot of good work there. He's often cited in Zero Hedge, so I'm sure you've probably seen some of his writings from time to time. Of course, what I wanted to do with this podcast was give you a chance to get to know him a little bit better and then discuss a few other topics in detail. So a little bit about a background about Chris. He's another guy kind of like me, or Jim Quinn comes to mind as well at the Burning Platform, and that Chris was just a regular guy. Has a degree in neurotoxicology, and was off that path, wanted to become a teacher as well, a professor perhaps. Ultimately, I guess, as I understand it, kind of saw the writing on the wall, and now has actually become a teacher, but with a much larger classroom. So with that, Chris, welcome to the TFMR podcast, and good morning.
Good morning, Turd. It's a pleasure to be here.
How did I do on the bio? Did I butcher that pretty well?
Yeah, that was awesome butchering. Very well done. Let me add one other thing to that, which is after my science career, such as it was, you know, PhD, postdoc, usual stuff, working with awesome microscopes and doing cool things, I went off and got an MBA and went into the business world and worked my way up, finally exiting as a vice president of SAIC in order to do this quixotic thing that I'm on, like you're doing, like Jim Quinn, like a lot of other people. I looked around, saw things that when I finally connected a few dots, I said, this is not right. I have to do something different. And I had to do a lot of things different, including changing my job, where I live, what I do, everything. So what we're about to talk about is I'm walking it. And talking it.
Well, and I thank you for making that point, because that's something I should have mentioned too. I mean, you're the real deal here, in that you saw what was coming, but you're not just out there, you know, shouting from the rooftops. At the grassroots level of your own family, your marriage, you've got three kids, you've changed your lifestyle, you've changed their schooling. You mentioned on your website you even know how to care for chickens. There's the validity of that, you know, the showing that you're not just, you know, someone who's out trying to make a buck off of a panic or something like that. This is, you're really doing it. You really believe what you're doing, and you're preparing your own family right at the grassroots level for what you see is coming over the horizon.
That's absolutely right. And, it is sort of a question of belief, but really fundamentally, it's just data. I'm looking at the data, and if the data changes, I'll change my opinion. But right now, I've got this opinion that we're on a really unsustainable course. Pressures are building, not getting better, et cetera. I mean, there's just so much to talk about. You know, every day is a new adventure in Europe, in the U.S., in the gold markets, in the paper money markets, in the monetary world. It's incredible what's happening right now. I mean, it's just anybody who can sort of be sleepwalking through the moment of history we're in right now, thinking somehow things are going back to normal, is just not paying attention.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing I fight too, and trying to convince people, because you have that normalcy bias, and that's probably the biggest enemy of the regular folks right now, is that all they know is this world in which they've grown up, the hegemonic U.S. superpower, and the dollar is the world's reserve currency, and getting folks to understand that tomorrow is not necessarily going to be like yesterday is the big challenge that we face, and getting people to wake up. To that end, I know you write a lot and think a lot about our economy and the level of debt, not only here in the U.S., but globally. Can you talk a little bit about the impact of how this will impact, I guess, the dollar and commodity prices as the U.S. and really the globe tries to service all of this debt, if it's even possible?
Well, it's such a confusing situation, because honestly, if there was another way out for people, let's imagine I'm the sovereign wealth fund of Norway, and I've got all this oil money, and it's right now it's just ones and zeros on a hard disk. Heck, you could fit the entire sovereign wealth fund of Norway onto a fob, you know. And so what do they really have? Ultimately, if you're China, Norway, Yale's endowment, if you're big money, what do you do, right? You know, so I've got myself diversified. I'm in the euro. I've got a little bit of Japanese exposure. I'm trying to get exposure to China. I've got U.S. And all of a sudden, I don't like the euro anymore because I don't like Spain creeping up to 6%, and I'm worried that the eurozone is going to break down. Where do I go? Well, you might go to the dollar, I guess, you know. And so really, my view of the future is wholly clouded by the idea that when I look at the macro picture, I say the United States' fundamental position is no different than that of Spain at this exact moment in time. They are both insolvent, mathematically insolvent. But now bankruptcy, legal term, different process. So what I'm seeing here is that even though the United States is fundamentally insolvent, it's not in bankruptcy right now. And so my method is I'm going to see the big money try and sort of dodge around and be as nimble as it can, like fleeing away from Spain. But where does it go? It ends up in the dollar, I think, ultimately, for a little while. But at the end of the day, it's very simple that if we're all insolvent, we fall right back to, if I do have a belief structure, it's this one quote by von Mises of the Austrian school, which says, listen, you know, what you either have, you have two options when you're at the end of a credit bubble. You either voluntarily abandon the credit bubble or you face a final catastrophe of the currency involved. The whole world is saying we loved the credit bubble. We had four decades of it. We can't give it up. We've tied all of our national budgets to it. All of our hopes and dreams are tied up in it. Our pensions are tied up in it. We need the credit bubble to just keep going. And it's mathematically impossible. Any sixth grader can tell you you can't forever expand your debts faster than your income. And that's what the Western world, including Japan, was trying to do. And we just can't give that up for some reason. So I think we face a final catastrophe of the currency system involved. I don't know when that's going to happen. This is playing out a lot slower than I ever anticipated. And I'm perfectly content on some level to just, you know, sit on my physical gold and silver and just sort of watch these things unfold in slow motion.
Probably the best strategy. We talk about it all the time here at TF Metals Report, the idea that you can trade that. You'll most likely bankrupt yourself before you end up really, I guess, profiting is not the right word, but profiting from holding gold and silver. In fact, Andrew McGuire told me last week that he had a statistic that said that 95% of the people that enter the silver market and attempt to trade silver on the COMEX are bankrupt and out of the market in 90 days. That's how quickly. So really, your only option, as you said, is to stack and hold and wait. To that end, you know, you were just mentioning that every central bank and every government in the world has tied their fate to blowing, reinflating this bubble and just keep shoving money out to try to make it look like there's liquidity, make it look like there's collateral. I find it amusing, if you will, that there is a general acceptance that the Fed and other central banks actively manipulates the currency markets. You see that in interventions by central banks all the time. We know through quantitative easing and the announced overt quantitative easing that the Fed actively manipulates the bond market. We strongly suspect by looking at the chart that the Fed actively intervenes buying S&P futures and supporting the stock market. But yet no one wants to believe that the Fed intervenes in the gold market. You wrote about that a couple of weeks ago and said, hey, that's good. It's good that they do because they're suppressing price. But I think all of us enjoyed that article. How do you feel about the manipulation of gold? Do you think that's an ongoing event, something you can use to your advantage?
If the Fed is not manipulating gold, I think they are derelict in their fiduciary duties as they are constructed right now. The Fed's job, its sole mandate, is to keep the credit bubble expanding, and its sole unit of operation is this thing called the dollar. That's its only product. That's the only thing it manages. It's got the dollar. That's it. It's like it's Apple, and all they've got is iPads. They don't have any of their other products. So that's it. But imagine if the iPad suddenly had a competitor that could tell you that if the iPad was either a good product or a less good product. You know, if I was managing Apple and that was my situation, you darn well better believe I'd be all over whatever that other competing product was. Right now, there is only one other monetary asset in the world monetary system that is not a fiat currency, and that's gold. You see it on central bank balance sheets. It's there. It's the only other asset they've got that is not somehow linked to or is not a direct derivative of this fiat currency that they've got. Right, so we have debt-based money on one hand, and then we've got this barometer on the other hand. Of course they're playing. They have to. You know, I spent my time in big business, and we conducted strategies, and we'd sit down, and we'd look at the competitors, and we'd execute against those strategies. It happens all the time. So, look, from a qualitative standpoint, I know that they're looking at and influencing the price of gold as much as they can, because I would be doing it if I was in their shoes. Mm-hmm. They have to, right? So that's the qualitative approach. The quantitative side says, look, there are these really odd, bizarre things that are happening in the market. I did trade futures for gold and silver. I'm one of the lucky people. I came out marginally ahead, but finally I got tired of the game because I realized I was not playing on a level playing field. I'd be sitting there trading using my silly things like TA and, you know, checking out charts and trying to understand where open interest was, and, you know, you get your once a week report, which is, you know, really not real time. But I'm playing against guys who have real time information. They see the whole book. You know, I can't tell you how many times I had a limit, you know, a protective limit just plucked off yep. of my trading screen there, you know, by this little raid that would come and just touch my limit and take it and walk away with the money off of that. You know, that happened enough times I realized, look, I'm just not playing a level playing field. I know that they stop it right away. They just...
Chris.
Are you back? I had a connection here.
We've lost you there. We had a little connection issue.
So what I'll do is I'll rewind and just say, but I know that whenever there's something happening in the markets that the authorities don't like, they stop it right away. So if there's a big imbalance, like if there's sudden huge number of sell orders coming in on a stock share, they'll suspend the market instantly and say, whoa, 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 we got to clear this out and figure out what's happening here. Not so with, say, silver, where you see these, you know, massive, massive raids come in, like some kind of, you know, HFT system comes in and just dumps thousands of sell orders, mm-hmm. you know, single one-minute bar in a thinly traded overnight market. You just know that's just not – that's not acceptable behavior. That is a market manipulating event. And regardless of who's doing that, that could be a hedge fund, it could be JP Morgan, it could be somebody, it could be the Fed, we don't know. But it needs, the fact that it happens and it's not investigated tells me that it is officially condoned. And that is de facto a form of manipulation in the market, that it, because it's not officially looked into, tells me that that manipulation of that market is an official act, right?
Yeah.
Because otherwise, the officials would step in and say, we have to understand what just happened here. I can guarantee you beyond a shadow of a doubt that if the reverse of that happened, if suddenly you had 30,000 buy orders hit the tape instantly for silver, spiking it by 20%, you would officially see the market shut down. They would investigate it. They would find out who was responsible for that, and they'd have them under some sort of regulatory action probably within a week, guaranteed.
Or what was the what was the size of the flash crash back in May of whatever that was, 2011? 10%, not even 10% in the S&P, 9%, so whatever it was. Which was bad enough as it was, and obviously due to some crashing of some HFT algorithms. But that prompted an investigation, that prompted new rules, you know, all this type of stuff. But it happens twice, three times in 8 months in silver, and
Well, even that was May 6, 2010, and what they also did is they broke the trades at an arbitrary level. They said, hey, we're going to abrogate these trades. They're done. So can you imagine if they stepped into the silver market and said, oh, you know, that whole thing where it was down 24% on that one night? I think that was 15%, right? They should have stepped in and broken those trades too, right?
Maybe not so much.
Not a peep.
Well, and to that end, you're absolutely right. And putting it as a dereliction of duty is a good way to put it, in that my contention as towards the basis of the manipulation has always been that the Fed must do it. Because if gold were allowed to trade freely and suddenly we're going up $100, $200 a day and trading at $5,000 an ounce, since so many people look at it as not only a currency but also an inflation hedge, how in the world would the Fed ever, or the Treasury, let's put it that way, be able to sell 10-year notes at 2% and 30-year bonds at 3% if gold was rising 50% a year and was at $4,000 or $5,000 an ounce. It must be contained if they're going to keep this Ponzi going.
Well, listen, here's a perverse view that I actually published in 2006. And my view was that as long as we were actually structurally facing a deflationary fear in the Fed, we would see rising gold prices. Not too fast, not too slow, but enough to sort of create the impression that maybe deflation wasn't a real big problem. Perversely, I happen to think, and I wrote this all the way back in 2006, that if inflation actually rears its head in the official statistics, we might actually see gold under more sustained assault, because the Fed is trying to use it as a signaling mechanism under that point of view. It's a, you know, it's a speculative point of view. Some might say controversial or even conspiratorial, but that was actually one of my key reasons for feeling safe holding gold. Was I saw that we were in a sustained deflationary environment, and knowing that the Fed has used gold as a signaling mechanism in the past, I said, well, I actually like being on this side of the trade, because the old maxim is really true: do not fight the Fed. Just don't.
No, very good point. Just a couple of other quick questions. You had, I think I saw something just the other day of you talking about silver, and I believe you personally own silver, isn't that right?
It's true.
There's been some discussion here just lately on my site about silver, whether it is a monetary metal, an industrial metal, or both, and the if we get to a point where there's some type of hard asset backed currency realignment, will anyone benefit by owning silver? I'm a firm believer in it. I think it's been money. Heck, we just heard back this weekend about Judas receiving 30 pieces of silver back to betray Christ. So it was money back then, 2,000 years ago. It's money today. Hugo Salinas Price has some great ideas down in Mexico. Your personal views on silver, and is it, obviously you must believe in it or you wouldn't own it yourself as a value, some portfolio money protection.
I love it for a whole bunch of reasons. The fundamental reason I love it is that we pull out about 700 million ounces a year, mostly as a byproduct of gold mining and other base metal mining, and a few actual silver mines. But we're actually consuming about 950 million ounces a year. So there's a structural deficit that's going on. And some of that consumption is for investment, right? Obviously, you know, SLV and PSLV and other ETFs like that are actually pulling in a bunch of silver. But we're in a structural deficit. It's an incredible industrial metal. I love it on that basis. But right now, if we said stop, we're going back to a gold and silver standard, I think we'd have trouble doing that, because all of the above ground stocks of silver that we see right now do not exist anywhere close to their historical ratio of 16 to 1.
Right.
Right now, we would expect, if there were a billion ounces of gold above ground, we'd expect to see 16 billion ounces of silver. We don't. It's pretty closely matched. There might be an equal amount of both metals above ground. Obviously, we could mine silver faster, but I have to connect this to the other part of my story, which is I see energy in a long-term structural rising price environment that honestly I think is going to last forever when it comes to oil. We're pretty much, you know, it'll wobble here and there, but you know, 10 years from now, we'll be looking back on, God, that was cheap. And because of that, I truly believe that mining activity is going to be slowing down over time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I truly think that you want a Rip Van Winkle investment, you say, listen, we're going to go through some hard times, but, you know, we'll recover, we'll come up from a new basic low. 20 years from now, what do I want to have? Like, if I could just right now buy something, 20 years I wake up, what is it? To me, that's silver. No question about it, we're going to be wanting it either maybe in a limited monetary role, but definitely for its industrial characteristics. Anybody who loves silver, please just look at what it does for us and the new uses we find for it every year. It is it's a magic element on the periodic table. It's awesome. So on that basis, I'm really comfortable with silver as a long-term hold. If you're going to trade it, you're going to get killed. It's a highly volatile. I truly believe it's also a manipulated metal, maybe for other reasons. The Silver Trade Association has been they obviously have an interest in seeing it low, and like any good trade association should. So it's been held down too long, too low. It clearly, if it went back to its normal 16-to-1 ratio, it should be in $100 an ounce range right now. I truly think that's a fair price for the metal at today's world. but I think it's going up a lot higher even from that.
Well, and that's a perfect segue into, I guess, my last main question for you. You've done a lot of work discussing energy shortages. There's this idea of peak oil out there, and it's another topic we discuss quite a bit here at TFMR. If you wouldn't mind, share some of your thoughts on energy consumption, energy supply, and energy costs going forward.
We don't have any sort of an energy shortage as a species right now. What we have is a liquid fuel shortage, particularly of the qualities that we want. And by quality, I mean the light sweet crude compared to heavy sour. So what we've done is we've fashioned an entire global economy by which 95% of everything that goes from point A to point B does so because of petroleum. Now, we could potentially someday build a whole bunch of electric cars, and we could someday come up with biofuels, and we could do all these things, but we haven't. And here's the interesting part of this story. Right now, when we look at just crude plus condensate, that's the typical stuff that comes out of the ground, it's been steady in a band for about 5 or 6 years now. And that's because we are pulling it out of the ground with new projects as fast as we possibly can. And yes, that's adding to new supply, but on the other side, what we're seeing is that the depletion of existing fields is exactly offsetting that. So as fast as we're drilling, and we're drilling really fast worldwide right now, because guess what? $100 to $120 a barrel oil, depending on whether you're talking U.S. or world oil prices, is a very high motivating factor. We are drilling as fast as we can, and we're just barely keeping up with depletion. That's exactly what we'd expect at this point in the story if we thought we were at something approaching what we would call peak oil, which is about flow rates. It's not about running out. It's not about saying humans aren't clever. It's not about saying we won't discover new ways to fracture rocks and do all sorts of other awesome things. It's just simply saying that geologically speaking, we will hit a point at which the rate of depletion and the rate of new discoveries and production being brought online will match for a period of time. And then eventually, even those new discoveries will get swamped out. And here's why. A new well in the Bakken field, awesome. Maybe 4 gigabarrels, maybe 20 gigabarrels, hard to say. Even if it's 4 gigabarrels, it's great. But every single well we drill out there has an average daily production of 150 barrels a day. Where, let's consider that, 150 barrels for a new well, we might be losing somewhere in the maybe 4 or 5 million barrels per day per year off of existing fields worldwide. Well, how many wells do you have to drill? Hundreds of thousands in order to do that. And we're drilling about 1,800 in that field right now. So we can't, it's extremely hard in this story for us to get more oil. Now, take a look at China, take a look at the rest of Asia, take a look at, including India and that, look at the rest of the developing world. They now exceed the consumption of the Western societies. That's a huge structural shift that just happened about 3 years ago. And it's increasing at double-digit percentage rates is the rest of the world coming on looking for this limited and limiting resource. So yeah, I'm a big believer that we are going to have a structural supply-demand shortfall. It will only be made up in price. The world economy is limping. We still see $120 a barrel oil. That's all the information somebody should need in order to make sense of where we are in this story. Tons of data. We could talk about it for all day long. But you know, all you need, 120 barrel in oil with the world teetering on the edge of recession. Put those two pieces together. I think you got a pretty good picture of where we're at.
It kind of tells a story, doesn't it?
It does. I
think as everyone can tell from listening, Chris is just has a vast store of knowledge and is a really quite an expert in several different areas. I would thoroughly and excitedly recommend to anyone listening to check out chrismartenson.com. That's Chris, and it's MartenSon.com. You'll see a link right here in the podcast. If you go there, the site is free. It has forums. You can join for free. If there is a premium membership where Chris does podcasts like this with newsmakers and opinion makers from around the world, and there's all sorts of valuable information if you decide to become a premium member. And Chris, if you could just take 1 second and kind of put a plug in for your Crash Course book and video series, because that I think is very valuable for people as they kind of get up and running as they embrace where we're going.
Sure. The Crash Course is the summary of my sort of intellectual tour through the big three E's, the economy, energy, the environment. And my point of view is you have to look at all three of these at once. And I weave a story that uses a lot of data, you know, and just facts as much as I can, no beliefs, that just says, look, if we put these three pieces together, what do we see? And that framework has been incredibly helpful for me in how I allocate my portfolio, what I invest in, what I don't invest in, what I do with my life. It's a decision-making tool. And so I invite other people to look at the Crash Course either as the video series, easily findable on my website, it's free, or the book, which is updated because the Crash Course came out in 2008. The book came out in 2011, so I had 3 years to percolate this a little more and put new stuff in there. Either source is fine, and I've even got shorter versions of public talks I've given that are maybe 30 minutes in length. If that's your total investment, you can also find those at the website. But what I ask people to do is at least look at the data and then accept it, reject it, refute it, argue it, debate it, do something with it, but don't ignore it, because we are at an incredible turning point in history, and the Crash Course helps you understand what that turning point might be.
Best you can do is begin to prepare. And Chris, you are a voice in the wilderness, crying out, helping us all see what's coming. Again, thank you for all that you do. I encourage everyone to make chrismartinson.com part of your favorites that you visit. Oh, I think, 8-10 times a day really would probably be a good idea, wouldn't it, Chris? You should go there and visit there as often as you can. It's a great site. Chris, thank you very much for spending some time with the crowd here at TFMR. And I hope we get a chance to visit again soon.
All right, Turd. It's been a pleasure.
Have a great day.
You too.